So, hello, Ewald. First question I have for you today is, considering that you are from Slovenia and you write in Slovenian, but you've travelled extensively, I'm interested to ask, would you consider yourself a Slovenian or an international author?
Well, I'm definitely a Slovenian writer since I live in Slovenia and write in Slovenian. On the other hand, having lived abroad for such a long time, having received most of my education in England and Australia, having written in English, having worked as an editor for English publishers, having travelled extensively in 96 countries to be precise, having absorbed so many different impressions and influences, including Eastern philosophies, it would be, I think, a little eccentric to claim that I'm a typical Slovenian writer. I'm certainly not perceived as such in Slovenia. Most of my novels are set abroad, in London, New York, India, Africa, and are not either thematically or structurally close to the Slovenian literary tradition. As for my plays, they're usually described as universal, both thematically and in terms of location, which makes it easy for them to cross borders, something that is almost impossible for Slovenian plays dealing with local issues. So in a way, yes, I could also be described as an international author, not only because of over 140 translations in 36 languages, but because of all the varied influences that are evident in my work. This is both a blessing and a curse. My writing can travel far and wide. It can work in culturally very different places and even in very exotic languages. But at home, in Slovenia, they're finding it difficult to slot me into any particular school or stream. So I stand alone, an author infected with the virus of cosmopolitanism, which is used both as praise and as a means of lessening the importance of my writing. Mostly as praise, I'm happy to add.
So Slovenians see you as a cosmopolitan writer. How would they label you, do you think? Well, they see you as cosmopolitan. So what prompted you to travel so extensively and to spend a lot of time abroad?
Two contradictory things, curiosity and fear. Okay. As a child, I was growing up in a beautiful village on the Austrian border, in a house on a hill surrounded by woods on three sides, with a view of the Austrian valley below and of distant mountains. And I would spend hours in my room on the first floor staring at those mountains, wondering what lay behind them, dreaming of the day when I would have enough money and courage to go and find out. But I was also afraid of the world, of the unknown, of the unpredictable. And when I was a student in Ljubljana, that's the capital of Slovenia, this fear became so great that it nearly paralyzed me. Fortunately, just in time, I realized that there was only one way of defeating it, by confronting it, by setting out into the wide world, regardless of what may happen to me. So I first moved to Vienna, from there to London, from there to Sydney, Australia, where for almost 3 years I worked as an underground train driver and made so much money that I could afford, with my second wife, who was Dutch, an overland journey back to Europe, which lasted a year. And it was that journey that turned me into a traveller, made me curious about exotic places and cultures, made me addicted to exposing myself to danger, to chance, to the randomness of life. Later, when we settled in London and our lives became orderly, and by becoming orderly eventually grew stagnant and rather boring, almost a form of semi-sleep, I realised that I could only wake up again and regain my full energy by regularly exposing myself to the shock of the new. And so a series of culture shocks provided by travelling to unknown and dangerous places became first a cure for stagnation and later turned into a form of addiction, requiring ever-increasing doses. Then travel itself was no longer enough. I had to write it all down. So I published 3 travelogues in Slovenia, very personal, very honest, and also humorous in an English sort of way. Now, at 70, I am I must admit, tired of traveling. The world has become uniform. It has lost its novelty and charm. One journey is very much like another. Things keep repeating themselves. Of course, I still travel, mostly to attend productions of my plays in various parts of the world, but this is no longer backpacking. And the only thing that makes these journeys interesting is the fact that I can look at the world through the innocent eyes of my 8-year-old son, who accompanies me as often as he can. Seeing wonder in his eyes, I too can see the world as though I were seeing it for the first time. And there is no better way of getting a new lease of life.
Wonderful. So, through travelling, I'm interested to ask about your relationship with the Slovenian language. How has it developed as you've spent so much time abroad? Does your Slovenian suffer, or does the distance from Slovenian make it freer for you to use the Slovenian language?
Well, lately it is my English that suffers, not my Slovenian. After all, it was 25 years ago that I moved back to Slovenia. And if you're not in daily contact with the language, it gradually ebbs away. Fortunately, only the spoken language, I can still translate my stuff into English without major problems. And I read mostly English books anyway, largely because they are cheaper. But there was a time when my Slovenian suffered considerably. In the early 70s, after 2 years in England and 3 years in Australia, when the only common language my Dutch wife and I had was English, and for 5 years I did not write in or spoke to anyone in Slovenian. When a Slovenian newspaper asked me to send them an article about the unusual Australian animals, such as kangaroos, wombats, etc., I bravely set pen to paper and produced, with the help of the English-Slovenian dictionary, mind you, what I thought was a fairly decent piece of work. Imagine my surprise when I received a letter from the editor. Dear Mr. Fleeser, are you trying to make fun of us? My elder brother worked as a journalist for this paper, and he told me that what I had sent them could only have been a joke. After all, I had already published a book of poetry, 2 novels, and numerous essays in Slovenian, and was known in the literary world as a bit of a stylist. What I had sent them resembled, according to my brother, something that would only have been written by a 10-year-old boy or by a newly arrived migrant from Bosnia. In other words, I had in fact forgotten how to write anything sensible in my own language. Back in London, starting to write in Slovenian again, as well as in English, I had to relearn the craft of writing in Slovenian. Inevitably, the influence of English remained evident in my prose to this very day, not only in the rhythm of sentences, but also in English phrases that I unknowingly translate into Slovenian, ending up completely surprised when people ask me what exactly I'm trying to say. However, the influence of English also gives my Slovenian, especially prose, something that people call special charm. It makes it unique in a way, in the same way that Conrad's or Nabokov's English is not really native British or American English, but a special kind of English. And so my Slovenian remains rather unusual, correct but different.
So you speak Flisa English and Flisa Slovenian.
Yes, let's put it that way.
So you talked about how you have... Your work has been translated into several languages and it's been read in this country and in several other countries. And so have you encountered, in your travels and when you've been watched your plays performed in other countries, for example, have you encountered different reactions to your work in different countries?
Oh, very much so. Especially when it comes to stage and radio plays, which have been produced in more than 20 languages. Let me give you just one example. The Japanese production of my most widely produced plays, What About Leonardo? It was produced in London at Lillian Bailey's Theatre, Sadler's Wells, in 1995. The play, which is loosely based on the book The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by the now late Oliver Sacks, it's a tragic comedy with 2/3 of it very funny, drawing laughter practically everywhere from Iceland to Indonesia, but not in Japan. I was shocked sitting there in my slippers because when you enter a Japanese theater, you have to take off your shoes, mm-hmm. and they give you a pair of slippers. And waiting for the first laughter, complete silence. Throughout the play, not a giggle, not a single giggle. I thought, my God, something has gone seriously wrong. Mm-hmm. So I confronted the director after the show and I said, why didn't anybody laugh? And he was shocked. He said, oh, what do you mean? I said, but this is a comedy, most of the way, until the very end. He said, yes, but in Japan, we do not laugh at people who are impaired in any way, either mentally or physically. That is not done in Japan. So, there you are. Nothing was wrong with the production. Mm-hmm. It was my lack of understanding Japanese culture. Mm-hmm. So, but mostly, I mean, this is an extreme example. But in every country, of course, even when people laugh, in different countries they laugh at different things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I see. So, in terms of being a European as well as a Slovenian writer, who would you name as your European literary influences?
Everything that I read influences me one way or another. So I cannot name any specific authors who may have influenced my writing in any particular clearly definable way. I know that this is the favorite sport of literary theoreticians, finding influences of other writers where there are none, to the extent that you may in the end believe that all writers in the world have influenced all other writers. But this sport is alien to me, largely because I find it useless. I can, however, state categorically that my playwriting has, for obvious reasons, been influenced by a number of British playwrights, ranging from Osborne, Pinter, Stoppard, to Joe Orton, Michael Frayn, Carol Churchill, and others. In fact, one of the characters in my latest award-winning play, Comedy About the End of the World, claims to be Joe Orton resurrected, and the play is written very much in his style.
Okay. And so, to continue, so this evening you're going to be talking at the European Literature Night at the British Library, so alongside writers from across Europe, and you'll be going on a journey and led by the host. So to what extent, just to know, do you consider yourself European, if I can use such a word, and how does that manifest itself?
Well, what does it mean to be European, and what is identity? Are we talking about geography? Are we talking about passports? Are we talking about culture? Slovenians have always been Europeans, especially during the thousand and more years when they were part first of the Holy Roman Empire and then of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. What else could they be? We have gone through all the cultural and political shifts that define Western culture: Renaissance, Reformation, Counter-Reformation, Enlightenment, Modernism, Postmodernism. We've always been a Catholic and partly Protestant nation. If that qualifies me as a European, then I will acknowledge it. I am European. Let's forget those 30 odd years of socialism when we were part of Yugoslavia. However, I also have an Australian passport, and I'm a British national. Does that make me more or less European? Who would know? Maybe David Cameron has that. But if we are talking about being European in a political sense, belonging to the European Union, then I would have to say that I am Slovenian and European to an equal degree, and that powers that be should not strive for uniformity, for some kind of Germanization of Europe, but should instead allow and foster national and above all cultural diversity, which, thanks largely to the advance of the digital age, is fast disappearing. So I could say that I am European, but I'm the sort of European who firmly believes that Europe will survive only by retaining its diversity.
Okay,
that's it.
Yes, thank you very much.
You've done it.
Yes.
Did it make any sense?
Of course.